We are now recording. And it is 6 o'clock.
Marla's muted.
There she is.
Hi guys, sorry. We are 6 o'clock, so calling to order the White Salmon Council meeting for June 17th, 2020. Jan, can you take roll call?
Jason Harmon.
Here.
David Lindley.
Here.
Ashley Post.
Here.
Joe Turkowitz.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Okay, are there any public comments that have been received by 5 o'clock today?
Yes, we received one public comment. It's from Scott Holbert. Dear Council Mayor and those representing our amazing city on this call, please expedite the approval for the upgrades to the White Salmon Bike Park ASAP. Community support for this project is basically universal. This project can be completed by simply allowing 1 to 3 people the ability to start the process. There won't be large work parties needed or even a need for major organized social distancing. It's a simple grading, source the correct soil donations, and have a machine operator create the jump lines. The process will take a couple of months to complete as described in the submitted plan. Mid River just completed a similar project in record time during the height of the COVID-19 outbreak. It's time to make this happen. Thank you, Scott Holbert.
So, Mayor, I talked to Scott today and told him that we would have something on the next agenda for an agreement. He said as of today, he understands the holdup, but as of the date, they've raised $28,000. So it sounds like they're ready to go.
Yeah, and I would just say, I was gonna mention this in my mayor update, but if we're talking about now, even though I think normally we don't respond directly to public comment, but I communicated with Scott last week what the situation was. We have a meeting already scheduled tomorrow, but just so the council's aware, this is something that we are ready to bring forward. The main thing from the city's perspective is that when the bike park initially started, there was never any sort of agreement in place. It is city property. And I think it's important going forward that we have a memorandum of understanding or something similar of what the relationship is when we are allowing city property to be used. So that's point one that will come before the council. And then the other part is just the acceptance, I believe, correct, Pat, of the determination of non-significance from their CEPA process. But the reason why, and perhaps Pat, this is what you explained to Scott, but certainly for a period, our meetings were functioning under the need of only critical and necessary matters. And this did not meet those guidelines. But we have been in contact with Scott. He knows that a meeting's already on the calendar for tomorrow. And we do expect that you guys will be seeing this on your agenda for July 1st.
Yeah, we had a conversation, even somewhat, what would be some of the details that would be in the agreement.
Great. And that was some of it too, is that we want to, out of courtesy, and obviously since he has been critical in maintaining and now moving that project forward, that we had a conversation with him and discussed this agreement before it just came before the council. Are there any other public comments, Jan?
No, that wasn't the only one we received.
Okay. Any requests for changes to the agenda from the council or staff?
I have one request. I sent that to you in email. We have a leak adjustment request from Innovative Composites Engineering. Any leak adjustments that are over $500 requires council approval per our code. We received this back in early June and I processed it and then just missed adding it to the agenda. So I would request that we add it after the downtown banners and prior to our executive session.
I'll make that motion.
Okay.
I'll second.
Ashley Post made the motion. Jason, did you second?
I did. Yeah.
Okay. Jan, can you take a roll call vote?
Jason Hartman?
Aye.
David Lindley?
Aye. Sorry, I was slow on the mute button.
Okay. Ashley Post?
Aye.
Joe Turkowitz?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Okay, moving into the agenda. Item one is the Jewett Parklets.
Do you want me to summarize it, Marla?
Yeah, I think you can give the general overview of the details that we've landed on, and then if there's anything else, I will add.
Okay, so you have your agenda memo. We early on had a request from, you know, the downtown restaurants to look at a way of increasing outdoor seating. We looked at several options and came up with this idea of what are called parklets. The city of The Dalles has been using parklets for the last 3 years during their summer months. The city of Hood River is already offered them up to, I believe, in their downtown locations and possibly up on the Heights. At the present time, I don't believe there are any being built or used in Hood River. And they've added in Hood River the takeout, designating takeout pickup spaces. And so my suspicion in downtown, they're going to use those versus parklet. So we did a Zoom meeting with the restaurant owners and came up with this idea of, you know, using up to per business a parking, an area that equals 42 by 8. On the north side, it would take up 2 parking spaces, while on the south side, it'd take up 3 to 4 angled parking spaces. Basically, this would provide each restaurant an equitable amount of space so that, like, one restaurant doesn't get 4 spaces or more. Everyone gets the same amount of space. In phase 2, you know, they'll have to determine, like, if they maxed out the parklet, what would be the capacity. And for phase 2, they'd get 50% of that. Phase 3, they would get 75% of that. And then ideally, if we move to phase 4 before Labor Day, they would be able to use the full capacity. We found some patio barricades that we provided a picture there for you as to what those would look like. So it's just not steel barricades. It's also these type of barricades offer us a flexibility on how we put them together for size. Steel barricades tend to be 8 feet long, period. And so that makes it difficult to size that up. Based on these costs, if we did 5 parklets, and I think I noted in here, or maybe I didn't, we budgeted for 5 based on that the Pioneer restaurant could be leased. And potentially you could have a restaurant in there this summer. They're not for sure what they're going to do with that, but the owners of that business said they could potentially lease that space out for another restaurant. So the cost, including shipping and sales tax, is estimated to be about $13,610. Just because shipping is always a guess, and I don't know how much this stuff weighs. I just saying that we were asking to authorize funding of $15,000. This money would come out of the COVID-19 pandemic, the CARES money, that $78,000 that has been allocated to us by the state of Washington. We, you know, as part of this, and you'll see in the motion that it's a finding to provide additional downtown restaurants that's beneficial to keep them financially viable during this pandemic. And then Marla probably will have some additional information. 2 of the 4 operating restaurants that are in place right now have asked for the parklets. One restaurant has declined the parklet. They want parking in front of their business and they have decided parking is more valuable to them. And we are waiting on the 4th business to contact us. And I expect to hear from them tomorrow or Friday.
Okay. I think that's a pretty good overview. Like Jan said, you know, this was the result of exploring a few different options. Some of that was in consultation with WDOT about what would be allowed on Jewett, but ultimately where we landed was very much informed by the preferences of the collective of restaurant, cafe, hospitality businesses in our downtown core. And as Jan mentioned, this was the only option that allowed some flexibility of some restaurants if they want to opt out and keep their parking versus other restaurants who feel, especially at this time, that it's more critical to have some extended outdoor seating options. So we feel like this is an approach the city could take to support the desires of those businesses that want to try to have more outdoor capacity. And I think the value add for the city also is that these are barricades that give us some flexibility long term for other types of use. Or if this is successful this summer, it could be something that we consider implementing on a seasonal basis, even once we're past the current need that we have, which is, as Jan mentioned, really based on, is this a way that we can help the businesses in terms of their reopening, being able to maximize as much as possible their anticipated financial streams and revenues that they can realize while having to reduce capacity. So I don't know if you guys want to have discussion first or if you want to bring a motion forward and then we can move into further discussion and answer any questions.
I have a question.
Sure.
Are the barricades easily obtainable? Like, what's the timeline for getting those in place?
I imagine there are a couple, probably 2 weeks out. The restaurants know that. I'm hoping we can get them quicker than that, but I'm anticipating probably the maximum date of 2 weeks. Some businesses Henny's is one of the restaurants that wants them. Their opening date for the restaurant is not until July 1st.
Okay.
I mean, they have their new little Pizza Leona takeout place that's currently operating. Stop by and check it out. Great soft serve ice cream. I had some today. but they don't intend to open their inside seating until July 1st. The second business that's interested in it is the Double Trouble, the wine tasting bar. And so I think he's currently open. And, you know, seating people at 50% capacity within the building, and he has a couple tables outside that are 6 feet apart. The business that were North Shore Cafe has chosen not to participate. They, again, believe parking is very essential to their business. And the business we're waiting on to hear from is Everybody's. If anybody follows their Facebook page, you know that they have a desire to take this extremely slow. And so I think that's what they're doing. And I think they're still mulling over how this would work for them. And we hope to hear back from them, like I said, today or tomorrow. I mean, tomorrow or Friday.
What does it look like for the city to gift these to businesses? What kind of transaction has to take place?
We're not gifting, so it's a use of the right of way. We'd probably create a right of way permit for them, but it's not gifting. We're not gifting them the barricades. The barricades belong to the city.
Okay,
it's up to them.
I can add to that. The AG has recently come out with a very favorable opinion about the city's authority to contribute to private industry where they've had an impact from the COVID-19 crisis. And this would be something that clearly be responsive to that need. And so I don't see any issues with making a contribution like this. It would be something probably the city would retain ownership of these structures and make them available for businesses that need them. And then also you could probably say waive right-of-way permit fees, which normally they'd have to pay. that'd be up to council. But, you know, so there are things that council can do to help these businesses that are in some need without being in running afoul of the Constitution.
I have a couple questions.
Yeah, Jason.
Where will we store them when they're not in use?
Well, we have, we have public works storage.
They'll be stored up at Spring Street, Jan.
Right. Probably where the Christmas decorations are currently being stored. There's a records container up there, and in early fall, after Labor Day, we'll be moving a bunch of those records out and shelving, and then that'll be like indoor storage.
Okay, I was curious if we had a place, so that's good. And then you said 5 sets. Is Tarwater in on that? Have you guys talked to them? I think he's opening till phase 3, but
yeah, he can't open till phase 3. We certainly sent information to Tarwater. We've heard nothing back from them. They could potentially have one space in front of their business, but it would literally be the only parking space in front of their business.
Right.
Because you have the police parking, and then there's all the parking for North Shore. My suspicion is he hasn't spoken to us, but I suspect he prefers parking. And he has some outdoor seating already, which he'll have to maintain. He'll have to set his stools up for that outdoor bar 6 feet apart. So, and because he serves primarily liquor, alcohol beverages, he probably has some different restrictions on how he serves, and all of these people that serve alcohol, they were reminded that they will have to check with the department, the liquor board, to ensure how they're able to serve out in that parklet any alcohol beverages.
Yeah, it seems like if they can't, it's almost not worth it, even for Henny's. But, and then what about Feast?
Feast is the restaurant that is, as I said, has chosen not to have a parklet.
Oh, they did? Okay.
They want parking.
So Feast and North Shore were parking?
Yep.
Got it. Okay. Just curious.
Yes, Ashley.
So one of the things I was wondering about is just the downtown is already pretty limited with parking at times. So I was wondering how many parking spots is this taking up, at least with the current plan? And was that part of the discussion with the businesses and the city staff about, because I know surrounding neighborhoods often complain about people parking on their streets to where they don't even have their own parking. So I'm just curious if there's a backup plan.
Yeah, and that has been part of the discussion, as Jan mentioned. That's why I think some of the businesses are choosing to maintain the spots that they have. There have been a few ideas thrown out there that have been explored. Some of those aren't able to be pursued, and kind of were along the lines of looking into additional spots in the alleyway. But there is ongoing efforts to see if some of the current lots that are further up Jewett that right now are private for businesses and off limits for public parking, if those property owners might be open to allowing parking in that area at nighttime. So the evening hours when those businesses are closed and the parking right now sits empty. Mm-hmm. And I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, Pat or Jan, but there is an overlap in this time period of when the parking where Radcom currently has their vehicles is moving. And so some of that parking might also be opening up this summer. Is that right?
So the main,
I'm not sure if it's this summer, but yes, there are plans for Radcom to relocate to another building in White Salmon.
So the parking crunch is primarily, particularly this year, maybe not next year, but the primary crunch is starting at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So Radcom's parking lot, all of the public parking lots, includes even where Radcom parks, those become empty. We've tried to advertise. I think it's really important that businesses advertise, that those parking lots are available for the public to use, including the one just north of the fire department. That parking lot, now that Sage Tech has left, is empty all the time. And so I think we need to remind our businesses, because I've been downtown on a Friday afternoon when it is jam-packed and no one's in the public parking spots. I mean, they're parking all the way up to Whitson Elementary. And for whatever reason, either they just don't want to park there, or they don't know they can park there, or I don't know why they don't park there.
Well, Jan, down on Church, on Jewett and Church, there's a two-by-three-foot sign that's parking that way.
There's one down here, too.
Up above, it's marked public
parking. I think some of it is just human habits, and some people, if they don't see that spot right there on Jewett, they aren't going to stop. Having said that, though, right now, with the counts that we have, there will still be more parking on Jewett than parklets. We don't know about everybody's, and so that could change it, but with the assumption that it's one business on the north side, Henny's, who's looking to do it, so that's two spots that will be taken up, and then outside of Dublé-Trublé, on the south side, we've estimated for that same 42 by 8 measurement, it's going to end up being four spots because of the way they're diagonal. So you would lose those four spots. So six spots right now. But the other thing that was expressed by the businesses collectively and what the city is maintaining throughout the summer is the continued carry out, takeout only parking, since so much of their operations are still dependent upon that. And I think this will help the parklets as well, is some more enforcement or just awareness of those spots that are for carry out and takeout being honored that way. So those two things combined, if used in the right way, are going to, you know, change some of the available parking that's there. But I think, as Pat and Jan said, in the bigger picture, it's the belief that even allowing these parklets isn't necessarily reducing the extent of available parking if people were using all of the options that are still in the downtown vicinity, because they've been unused.
So is the plan that we would buy five sets regardless, or just buy them for the business, or to authorize for five and just buy them for the businesses that want them?
Right. So at the present time, I mean, I think we need to be judicious. I mean, it's totally, Marlo may have a different recommendation. My plan was to originally buy for the businesses that said they wanted them. And then if for some reason the Pioneer Pizza Place miraculously had something go in there between now and Labor Day and they wanted one, again, they have that upper level, they have quite the store frontage there, so they have that upper level area that has quite a bit of seating up there for them. And it's a little bit of a drop there for them to get to the road. So, I mean, if I was a restaurant owner, I'd just stick to the upper level and not try to figure out how I'm going to get down to the road and serve people down there. But you never know. People have different visions of how they
live. Yeah, and Henny's has the same thing.
Well, they seem to not have a problem with it. They want it. But they don't
know. No, I know. I'm saying they also have the upper seating. But my concern is that if it's determined that they cannot serve alcohol out there, and the two businesses that want it, Dublé-Trublé and Henny's, are the ones, you know, it's useless. If they can't, Henny's won't see people there if they can't serve them alcohol. And Le Dublé-Trublé, I don't think, has anything else to serve.
Right. Well, I think they have.
Well, the liquor board, I will say, has made concessions already to help accommodate businesses, you know, the carry out or the cocktail kits, which are being done both in Washington and Oregon. And again, we reiterated to them they need to make sure they're in compliance. However, and I don't know off the top of my head, and Ken, I'm not sure if you've dived into this, but in our conversations with WDOT and conversations I've had, I know that other communities in Washington are exploring this for restaurants. And so that is a good point. We should confirm, and maybe it would be good for us to know and not just rely on the restaurants, but based on the actions that have been taken in that direction, leads me to believe that it is allowed if a business is already permitted for serving alcohol outdoors, which Penny's is. And I think that that's where the barricades also factor in. Mm-hmm. I know that in the applications that Hood River has, and again, that's Oregon, but they're pretty clear about alcohol needing to remain within that perimeter area that's being added.
And that's Stevenson. Why on the design, we designed barricades up against the curb. So there was kind of basically a gateway into the parklet so that it was just not like wide open that anybody could, you know, just freely, you know, take their beverages in and out. And so currently, as you know, beverages are, have been, and in the past been, at least with Henny's, served out on to their upper sidewalk already. So I don't think it's a problem with Henny's. Again, Tarwater's been, they've had people out on their upper thing. They do chain versus Henny's. They totally barricade that area when they put up a chain so people can't walk through there. And that might be because, again, their business is slightly different. Yeah. I mean, it's a different license. It's a bar, right? Yes, yeah, a different license than Henny's.
One question to Jason is, you know, how is it handled when we have Springfest and there's a beer garden in the park and alcohol is served in that closed-in perimeter off-premise from a restaurant?
You can't leave it.
But they're drinking it in a temporary setup. Yes. That's not.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's probably fine, but it's not in the road.
Isn't there a permit for that as well?
Yeah.
Yes, they have a temporary liquor license for that. And so anytime you do that at an event like that, it has to be cordoned off. You have to show proof of ID to get inside the cordoned off area, and you cannot take your alcohol outside of that area. So yeah, when they used to have the wine and art fusion, how they handled that with the wine tasting in the past is, and I've been to some other festivals where they do this, they will check your ID at the gate and they will issue you a bracelet of a certain color. And so, you know, as you know, children used to be allowed in that cordoned off bigger area, but because it was, you know, I think a different type of function, the liquor board did allow that wine and art fusion.
And we used to close the road as well.
Right.
It's probably fine. I just feel like on the off chance that it isn't, it would be essentially a non-starter. We'd have all these barricades with little to do with.
We can ask Henny's and La Double Trouble we could put the onus on them before we order them to say, we'd like you to check with the liquor board about serving alcohol on this location that's got a sidewalk and it's out on the street. You know, there's separation from their business, mm-hmm, and have them get back to us on it. I think it's their onerous. We kind of express that.
Can I weigh in? Stevenson,
yes,
as you know, has Highway 14 running down the middle of their city. They also have restaurants along Highway 14 that have asked essentially the same question. And my recollection, well, it's a two-part issue. One, if we're going to issue a right-of-way permit, we'll have to make sure that we have dram shop protection insurance for any uses within the right-of-way where alcohol is served, and that we're additionally insured for that. And then secondly, my recollection was that the LCB allows it, especially, kind of it's a COVID thing, but they allow it if the city allows it. So it'd be kind of up to you guys to allow it. I can't remember. I don't think it has to be by ordinance. I think they can allow it by resolution. But, you know, so it really, it's, they're kind of bending over backwards to accommodate the restaurants under these circumstances to allow these parklets. And so, I'll probably know more from Stevenson as that progresses. They're in phase three, as you know. So we'll see what happens with Stevenson's restaurants. But that was my recollection of how it's processed through the LCB.
Yeah, just to address Jason's concern about barricades, there's always a reason to have more barricades than we have, Jason. Okay. They could actually be used for Spring Fest or Public Works, either one. We wouldn't just buy them and they would sit around forever and never be used. They would be used for other things.
Yeah, that was going to be my question, and I think that's great. I think it's a cool idea if the restaurants want it, and it would be unfortunate if it was only this summer and we couldn't do it in future summers. But you know, we've all been to tourist cities where the streets are packed with people eating and drinking and having fun. I think
yeah,
it could be cool.
I did let WashDOT know that we would be evaluating how they worked this summer and talking to our, talking to our restaurants about how they work and if they wanted to continue this process into the future and what it would look like. WashDOT is actually very supportive of this. They actually said that Bingen was the first city that came to them, not Stevenson, and asked for permission to use the street in some fashion to help out the restaurants. And they actually said, we, not Stevenson, are the cutting edge in the state of Washington. And so the only thing I would caution, and this is my caution about ordering 5 sets, is that if the restaurants don't use them, we cannot use that money, that CARES money, to pay for those. So that's my caution. We would end up using, city funds to pay for those barricades if the restaurants don't use them. And so I think the liquor side of it, I have a lot less concerns about that. It sounds like Ken has less concerns, Pat. Everybody has less concerns about that. And my biggest concern is ordering barricades that, at least for this summer, wouldn't be used for the pandemic purposes, and therefore we would have to spend city money to cover those costs.
So we're ordering 5 sets, and currently one of those sets is for the Pioneer Pizza space, if in case another restaurant comes in. Is that correct?
We budgeted for up to 5 sets. So when we use this word to authorize funding up to, it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to spend all of it. And again, this is a council decision, but my recommendation is to purchase sets for restaurants who have committed to using them. And that later, if a restaurant sees like, oh, maybe I made the wrong idea, the wrong decision, then they could come back to us and ask us to order, ask for a parklet.
David, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I was going to kind of say in summer, I'm very supportive of it. I appreciate the work that's gone done to talk to all the businesses. So it's kind of a collective decision that they're aesthetically pleasing. So I think they really can be repurposed. And to speak to Jan's last comment, I think we're authorizing up to 5. And I would assume that before Jan hits click, that she's had multiple more conversations with the businesses and that we're judicious about just having solid confirmation on how many are actually going to get used. So hopefully it can be paid for by CARES, and then we have, extended uses down the road. Could be a win-win.
Any other questions or thoughts?
I have one more. So was this meeting primarily to talk about the parklets, or was it just to touch base with businesses? I was just curious if there were any more thoughts or ideas or requests from business owners towards the city.
It was the restaurant.
Yeah, sure. So the main thing was to figure out if there was a way forward on an idea to help with outdoor seating.
Okay.
But as I mentioned earlier, one thing that was expressed in addition to that would be helpful is just if the enforcement on those carryout takeout spots could maybe be implemented so that it really was 15 minute, because it was the feeling from some of the business owners that people were just back to parking in those and not honoring that it's supposed to be for pick up and go. We have been in contact with the businesses though throughout this period. And this meeting was the result of hearing from some of those owners as these phase guidelines were coming out, just some of the concerns around what could be done potentially with the city to help them on some of these capacity restrictions, because if they open for dine-in at the reduced capacity, it's kind of this double-edged sword. Like, it's tough to make it work, but you want to get back into business, but trying to just weigh it. So it seemed like this was an area where the city could support to some degree.
Okay, thank you.
I'll make a motion to authorize expenditures of CARES funding up to $15,000 for parklet barricades, finding that additional outside seating for downtown restaurants is beneficial to keep the restaurants financially viable during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Okay, is there a second?
Yeah, I'd second that.
Jason Hartman made the motion, David Lindley seconded. Any more discussion? Okay, Jan, can you take a roll call vote?
Jason Hartman.
Aye.
David Lindley.
Aye.
Ashley Post.
Aye.
Joe Turkowitz.
Aye.
Motion carries.
Okay, moving on to item two in our agenda, tenant protection. So to set this up and sort of jog everyone's memory, since it's been a while, this is something that had been a discussion point prior to the COVID-19 restrictions on our meetings. And we're bringing it back forward to the council now with some of the feedback we received then, which was primarily kind of a better breakdown of what the city or the council could be considering as new protections against what's already in the state Washington Landlord Tenant Act. And so the goal tonight is simply to get some input and feedback from the council so that staff has direction on any of these protections that you might want to move forward into actually drafting into code, those that you might not want to pursue, and any that aren't listed that perhaps because of reviewing this now you have other ideas you'd like to consider. But that would be the next step. And then ultimately, once that is cleaned up and put into some sort of a proposed code, we would move forward with a public hearing that so we could get feedback on these protections that are proposed. So nothing new was added from what you saw last time, but just to review, you'll see now that it's separated. So the breakdown list, what you're really considering on policy for White Salmon would be those, the section called additional proposed city landlord requirements. So those three things currently aren't covered in the existing state landlord requirements, and the options to consider there would be a 60-day notice to vacate month-to-month tenants for no-cause termination. So what that's allowing in theory is more of a notice for people. Landlords right now have the right to evict for no cause. And so in that dynamic, this is allowing more lead time for tenants that would be not on an annual lease and potentially in a more vulnerable situation. Second one would be no more than one rent increase in a 12-month period and a consideration of a rent increase freeze for first renewal. And then the last one would really just be putting it in writing, the requirement that landlords have to distribute that full tenant rights as part of entering into a lease agreement with a tenant. The items under already required were things that were originally presented to you but are already state laws. And then the second area that the council would be considering as new policies that you could take action on would be those additional proposed tenant protections. That includes some sort of a structure for allowing installment payment options for the various deposits and fees that often are burdensome on a new lease signing or upfront cost. And then simply an additional protection that tenants with disabilities do have a right to request a written reasonable accommodation for landlords to serve any notices in that format that is desired or best for them to receive the information so that they fully understand it.
Weren't we supposed to talk about the ICE? Sorry. Weren't we going to do that?
No, that's after.
I think ICE is after downtown banners.
Okay. Sorry.
My bad.
That's okay. but I was going to say it might be better to just have the discussion so that, you know, again, there's not necessarily a set action coming out of this. It's more to bring this back to you guys, have a renewed item of topic for you to consider and figure out, just get a pulse or a sense of what your energy or appetite is for moving this forward at this time or revisiting at a later date or adding or changing anything that is currently being presented.
So to have a public hearing, we would need to provide a proposed ordinance to the public.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I feel like I have a desire for more of an open-ended public hearing just to hear from tenants and landlords in our community what issues they think are particularly necessary.
So if you remember, Ashley, we did get some public comment.
We did.
On this issue. It was fairly broad, but and I think it was the result of the trailer court evictions.
Yeah.
And so they weren't specific to an ordinance. I think having a written ordinance or a draft of one is beneficial to the public. It gives them the parameters on which to comment, and then also it allows tenants and landlords to say either you need more or you need less. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, then it gives them some meat to chew on.
Yeah. I have the hesitation of, I was talking with Marla about this earlier today. I feel hesitant about, having too many restrictions or over-regulating, and going to a place where it might just be more of an incentive for landlords to switch over from, long-term rentals to short-term rentals. And so I have some hesitation around that, but when I was a renter, I definitely would have benefited from some of these policies. And I would definitely like to hear public comment surrounding this. So, I'm definitely in favor of moving forward with the proposed ordinance, but I'd love to hear from the rest of the council because I struggle to know how much, if we should include all of these proposals, or if there's any in particular that the rest of you are leaning towards. Mm.
So just a quick comment, just because you consider a proposed ordinance or an amendment to any particular code that's brought forward and you hold a public hearing, it does not mean you have to adopt it. You can decline to adopt, it can either fail from a lack of a motion to approve it, or you can move to approve it and it fails because the majority of you vote against it. So mm-hmm. I think it's a good reminder that sometimes, you know, stuff does get brought forward in an ordinance format, but it ultimately may not go anywhere because after listening to public comment at a public hearing or after weighing all of the pros and cons, a city council may say, no, we're not ready to do this, or this is just not what we want to do.
Yeah. One concern I also have, I'm sorry, go ahead, Joe.
You finish up.
Another concern is just if we had everything in here, it could end up being more of a lengthy proposed ordinance, and that might discourage some people from reading every bit of it. But in that case, maybe if there was a memo briefing people what the main changes are, kind of like we had when we were first looking at the mobile home zone ordinance.
So remember that the only things that would be in here would be, unless the council wanted to reiterate, I mean, you wouldn't reiterate the state protections. They're already state
law. Yeah, it would just be the proposed changes. But I do think that's a good point, Ashley. Mm-hmm. The summary that we've provided for the mobile home zone, probably a similar type of approach for any proposed change, is more helpful for the public. Joe, did you have a comment?
Yeah, there's just some language in there that I doesn't really read right to me. Like when you say a 60-day notice to vacate under the additional proposed city landlord requirements, number one, month-to-month tenants, that kind of goes against month-to-month on its face. So it's kind of changes the term that's an established term. So I just don't, you know, the broad scope of this, I just don't really follow how it's enforceable and in what way, because the Landlord Tenant Protection Act itself is decided in district and superior courts, if I'm not mistaken. There's really no agency or body that regulates before that. So I don't know what happens when the city puts itself in the position in front of that.
I think it adds a defense potentially to a tenant. That's how it appears in a court setting.
But still in court, right? Like this wouldn't make the city like a pre-court or a mediator. It wouldn't be in front of that.
No, unless the city has some regulation where the city is somehow involved in that relationship. But normally it would just be something the tenant would assert in a landlord tenant proceeding and cite whatever city code is has been adopted for the judge to consider as a potential defense.
And this is kind of requisite on them getting a rental license too, correct?
Yeah, I think, although that, I don't think that would necessarily be a defense. That's more city enforcement of its own code for the landlord.
That's a business license.
Yeah, that's a business license issue. But the other ones, providing adequate notice and providing like language support and those sorts of things, those are potentially defenses a tenant can assert in a, say, an eviction proceeding. So that's how that works.
And then just to speak to the month-to-month thing, I mean, my experience in watching these tenant protection laws go into place over the last probably 2 years is that the 60-day notice thing, and in some states it's even longer, or cities, there's a movement to do away with that month-to-month leasing process, which then probably leads to Ashley's comment about those types of landlords will move off of they're not long-term rentals, and they do that on purpose, right? Because then they can, at their whim, choose, oh, I don't want my renter in this month because I can do a short-term rental or whatever. And then they bump them out, and then those people have no place to live, particularly in a difficult rental market. Right. So that's where that notice process came up. And has been developed by states and cities is to try to prevent that month-to-month rental situation.
Right, and in playing devil's advocate on opposite of that point too, it's like if you consider the landlord's position that the tenant can, a lot of leases revert to month-to-month after the term of the lease expires. So that it gives a tenant that same month-to-month, like, hey, I found another place, I can quickly get out of here. And so, leaving a landlord with a unit middle of winter is more difficult to rent than, start of summer here particularly. So, I can see where people might, have a issue with that not being or expressing reciprocity in the terms equal to the landlord and the tenant.
For the council, go ahead, Jason.
Sorry, my understanding is that the law already does not allow you to require a tenant to sign a lease after the first year. You have to let them go to month to month if they want to, right? Am I wrong to understand that?
I think unless there's additional language, but I think that's the standard.
Yeah, because we, I was researching that pretty recently, and I think that you have to allow your tenant to go to a month to month if after the lease expires. You can't require them to sign another lease.
But then they face the 30-day notice to vacate.
Right. And so this would give them the 60 days.
Right. So, and then this, and I have also another question about additional proposed tenant protections. 1A, the 25% amount. So like if you have $1,000 a month rent, if I'm reading this right, the aggregate of the deposit and last month's rent, if it's more than $250, that would trigger that. And also the way it reads, the tenant may request in writing to pay the total amount in installations. Do they have the right to request it and then get denied by the landlord, or is that request to be obliged by the landlord?
Those are good points. And I actually think that that was, you brought that up the first time, and the 25%, I think we flagged then as in interpretation, probably not making sense for that reason that you just identified, that most likely it's always going to be exceeding 25%. I also think too that interpretation of tenant may requesting, the intent of this would actually be to, if it's asked for, then it's honored. So that probably does need to be reworked. But in bringing this forward to the council, that's where I was coming from, was that if something like this was to be considered to be added, and it was added, that what it would be providing is that if any tenant were to ask for this consideration, then they can receive it. So not having it be something that someone asked for and then it could still be denied. And again, the motivation here is really about trying to equalize what is often something that cancels out some individuals from the rental market or from rental opportunities that might otherwise work for them if it weren't for a significant upfront cost burden that they financially can't afford to cover in that lump sum payment.
So there's also no verbiage that says that couldn't be grounds for not selecting that tenant, right? I guess
that's a good point too.
So let's say that we said if the tenant requests it, the landlord has to honor it. If I have three tenants and two of them want to pay the deposit in installments and one of them doesn't, is that a no-brainer for me, which tenant to choose?
Yeah, that's a good point. And that the goal would be to not end up in that kind of scenario. So if you guys wanted to move this forward, I think that this proposed draft of how the policy would work needs to get revisited and fine-tuned, because the end goal would be that you're not adding another opportunity for discrimination or another opportunity for a perceived right by a tenant to be exercised and then have it denied.
Right. And I also had a question about the rent increase freeze for first renewal. I don't understand that at all.
Yeah. And again, these are ideas coming before you guys. And I think some, it sounds like you might move on and others you won't. But the thinking there is that, you know, to prevent a situation where someone signs into their first 12-month lease and then in the next 12-month renewal, there's a significant rent increase. Does it help to provide for better housing security for long-term renters if they know going in that the lease that they're signing year one is a rate that will be protected in year two? So that would be the first renewal. And then the other part of that is no more than one overall rent increase in a 12-month period for long-term renter or for a year-long lease.
So I guess I'm still not understanding the math on that. If I'm a landlord and you have a one-month or 1 year lease, I could increase your rent one time, but then when it comes to renewal, I cannot?
No. So maybe it's the fact that it's 2 and 2A, because really what it's saying is that for year two of a renewal, there could not be a rent increase from what the year one price was. Year three onward, no more than one rent increase in those 12-month periods for renewals. Does that make more sense?
It does.
Explaining it that way?
Yeah. I feel like it would need to be fine-tuned because it just seems a little vague, but I see you going there. I keep going back, or, you know, I think I research it, but I'm pretty sure that you can't require a tenant to sign a second lease.
So Jason?
Yeah.
I'm looking at RCW 59-18-210. And it specifically states here that unless you have a signed legal document, you can't do year-to-year leases. However, there's nothing in the RCWs that I found that says, you know, you as the landlord can tell your renter that I'm requiring 1 year written contract leases. And so if your renter wants to stay in your house, apartment, whatever it is you're renting, treehouse, whatever it is you're renting year to year, I believe you have the right to say, I am requiring year to year leases in writing by contract. You're right.
Well, functionally.
If you and your tenant agree that you don't want, both of you agree, both parties say, I don't want to do a year-to-year lease, then it's the month-to-month or indefinite time period. And, you know, those, you know, then, and then there are some specific requirements on termination of those indefinite or month-to-month rental periods. But if you do a year-to-year lease, it must be in writing, and there's nothing that prevents the landlord who owns the property saying, that's how I choose to rent my property, is year to year with a signed lease.
Ken, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I do. So functionally, in Washington, both residential and commercial leases that exceed 1 year have to be in writing. That's a statute of frauds issue. And then secondly, functionally, what you have when a one-year lease expires is what's called a holdover provision, that any holdover tenant in Washington defaults to a month-to-month lessee. That's the law, that's the way it works. But it's not necessarily to the tenant's advantage that it then shifts to a month-to-month lease. And most landlords, as they're approaching the one-year expiration, will indicate to their tenant that if they want to have a one-year lease, they offer the one-year lease. Otherwise, they're subject to a shorter, a no-cause eviction process. And most tenants will want to avoid that if they're happy there, and they'll go ahead and sign a one-year lease or whatever extension the landlord calls for, which, again, will have to be a written lease. But that's kind of how it works.
Yep.
Joe?
So in that situation, then, if the landlord was prevented from increasing the rent on the second term, there'd be nothing to keep them from terminating the lease and then finding a new tenant if they wanted to raise the rate.
It would need to be tweaked because, again, I think nothing compels the landlord to extend that lease beyond the one-year lease period. And so it might have an undesired consequence of a landlord after a year finding a new tenant and in order to effect an increase. So I think I think the language would have to be tweaked. You want to, on all of these kinds of provisions, you have to anticipate unintended consequences. One of the unintended consequences of prohibiting a landlord from increasing rent to stay with market is that they'll start with a higher rent, because they're anticipating they can't raise the rent in the future. So it's it's a complicated equation. I'm not suggesting that it's not a good idea, and other cities have implemented some of these more stringent tenant favorable requirements, but there are sort of other things that can happen as a result.
Right. I feel like the language needs to be razor sharp to represent the intent. And, you know, that's, it's easy to write a contract or a lease or an action to work around that. And it seems like it'd be difficult to pin this one down.
Maybe a good way forward also, if there was interest from one or two counselors and there is a consensus out of this evening, to work on fine-tuning how you would like these policies to be revised or modified. And then that can be the foundation for what staff takes forward into an ordinance. That way, you know, there can be a little bit more guidance, I think, so that what you guys are presenting or wanting to move forward with to a public hearing is more detailed, to make sure that, you know, because I think this has been a good conversation. There's certainly right now some loopholes that aren't intended that are in there.
It might be helpful to look at maybe not a city the size of Seattle, but to see what other medium-sized cities have done with this. I don't know if any of the cities that Ken represents have tackled this yet. I do know the city of Vancouver, I believe, did tackle some of this. So it might be helpful to look at what other cities have already put in place. And, you know, this was quite the...
Yeah, these...
You know, and what
their language... These were all informed by examples from other Washington cities. So I could go back and find the references
language
to other city codes to see how they were interpreting kind of these ones that are now part of what you're considering.
Yeah, to see their actual code language.
Yeah.
Were you able to find other cities that had examples of the broken up security deposit in last month rent?
Yeah. I want to say off the top of my head that Tacoma is definitely a city that has that. But I will check. But it has been implemented in other Washington cities.
I think Seattle has it. Seattle has a lot of tenant protections.
Yeah, theirs are pretty expansive.
Right.
In addition to the state.
But if we looked at a subset of theirs, that could be, you know, if we picked and choose, we'd at least know that they would hold up in court.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know they've been tested that far yet, right, Ken?
There's probably there have been some that are tested in Seattle. I guess we could check on that as well.
Yeah.
Are there any on the two proposed lists, the three items for landlords and the two items for tenants, that the council does not want to continue to edit or consider or revamp? Or at this point, would you like all of those five to kind of get a further refinement with some examples of how they're written into code of other cities so that we move towards drafting tighter language around these concepts that then could be a proposed ordinance for consideration to take to the public?
So I think what Marla's suggesting is like just kind of take some ideas and from other cities and put it into a code format for you just to consider. So like this is what a 60-day notice to vacate would look like. This is what the no more than one rent increase in a 12-month period would look like. And then you can actually see the written code language that you know, this is just sort of a summary of that language. And then that would give you some fodder to feed on or to chew on. And then from there, you could give us direction. It's like, yes, we like 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. We like them all. Here's some minor tweaks. Put it in a code, schedule a public hearing, and move forward. Or we like 1 and 5. We don't like 2, 3, and 4. Or no, we don't like any of it. You know, so then that way at the next council meeting, you know, maybe the July 1st meeting, you've got these 5 items, you know, in a code format that maybe helps you be able to see as a resident or citizen of White Salmon, what does that language actually look like? And then of course Ken would have reviewed it prior to that meeting also before we sent it to you, so that it has his legalese touch to it, and would be, we hope, defensible in court.
Yes, Ashley.
I think that
you might be on.
I got it. So I would be interested in seeing all 5 of those, like examples taken from other cities and revamped in our White Salmon way. With as far as the month to month, I was wondering if, you know, maybe we could have a definition that divides month to month versus long-term rental that has a longer lease, so that if there's that 60-day notice, that would specifically be in reference to a longer contract. So I know there's some people who really benefit from having a month-to-month lease, and we don't want to dissuade that.
And you can always, I mean, it looks like Vancouver has a 60-day vacate policy as well. I think you could always, the landlord and the tenant can always, you know, work something out on their own. Because additionally, if a tenant does break a lease, they're not really on the hook for the remainder of the lease, because the landlord has to try to re-rent the property as quickly as possible, and the tenant's only on the hook for the portion of the lease that the landlord can't rent it for. So, I mean, I'm okay with moving forward with all 5 of these, looking for better examples. But I, you know, also keep in mind that there are tons of protections, you know, a lot of the tenant protections are kind of in for some of these things when it comes to, at least when it comes to breaking a lease, are already there.
Yes, David.
Yeah, I just, say I'm supportive of all 5 moving forward. I mean, I'm with you in spirit. Obviously the devil's in the details, as a couple of folks have really pointed out. So I guess just being judicious about how much staff and legal resources we burn to polish these a little bit, given still have a public hearing and more consideration to come.
Good point.
Yeah. I think that is a good point. And again, you know, maybe it would be good to get a sense from council on how quickly you would like to see this come back to you. Is this something that you would like to see in the very near term, or is this an item that could be returning to you late summer? And maybe by then there will be more opportunity for a different type of public hearing, or depending on where we are in phases, but that might be good for us just to gauge too, like how quickly you want the turnaround, because that will then impact kind of the time that staff puts into it and how we fold it into other projects.
Well, do we feel that this is a critical component for coming out of the moratorium? And if so, then I think we should move quickly.
I don't feel that way.
No,
I feel like this is something that I would really like us to move slowly on, and put a lot of thought into, and not feel compelled to go with it just because the ball is rolling. my main purpose is I want to be able to hear from landlords and tenants, but I don't feel strongly that we necessarily need to create our own policies. I just want to be better informed.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think your point about dissuading landlords from doing leases is also something that I hadn't considered, but is very much, I think, a very good point. And I guess the only reason I said that was because I would like to see us move through the steps required to release the moratorium. And if this is one of them, then I say that we should you know, try to keep it moving. If it's not, then I agree. I'd be okay to take this a little slower as well.
Yeah, and I think on that note, you know, I was going to mention the moratorium tonight, obviously, during the updates and let you guys know where we stand at the mobile home zone. But specific to your comment there, you know, I think not knowing what the future held when we implemented the moratorium and had none of the later impacts of COVID-19 actually occurred, the intent that existed at the beginning to really dive in, dedicate staff focus, dedicate council, dedicate planning commission to assess in a big picture all these dynamics of housing and how it could be more affordable and attainable and achievable for all sectors of our community was a very noble intent and was set up that we could achieve it. But needing to adapt to what's happened with COVID, I think the viewpoint that I have is in line a little bit, Jason, with what you mentioned, which is we couldn't anticipate what unfolded. I think that a lot of the work that we wanted to do in a dedicated time can continue to move forward, tenant protections being one of them, but that urgency that was tied to the moratorium, the vision that we could have all these things implemented and come out of it with a very clear and clean, multifaceted approach is not really a realistic direction to keep the city in right now when so many other things have impacted people's opportunity and ability to move forward with projects or other development in those zones. I think we're already going to see a decrease for the rest of 2020, and a lot of this work can continue on a time frame that's more realistic with all the limitations we're having to adapt and adjust to without having to extend the moratorium. I do think the mobile home zone is one of the more pressing things, and we are moving to keep that coming before you before this moratorium expires. But from the perspective of this coming back to your agenda tonight, it was not to imply that this is a critical thing that needs to be done and signed by the city council before July 15th. It was certainly with the intent, and that is the way we're going, is that we are going to be bringing back and still trying to tackle all those things that we identified as part of the moratorium, but trying to be more realistic and mindful of what's the right way forward to address and deal with all of the detours that no one saw coming as a result of the pandemic. So with that, I think Jan and Pat, are you guys clear on kind of next steps for tenant protections? And then if it's okay with council, it sounds like we won't be prioritizing this to come back on an agenda next meeting or even the meeting thereafter, but we'll be working to bring this back to you in a timely manner. So most likely later in the summer is realistic.
I think that's very realistic for staff to work on and address, getting these into some kind of code format and making sure that Ken reviews them. And then, you know, bringing them back to the council. And then, you know, if the council's agreeable, then schedule that public hearing so you can hear from tenants and landlords about these ideas that are in clear language.
Yeah, I have no problems with that.
Wow. Okay. Any other counselor thoughts or last final questions? Okay, seeing none, we'll move to item 3, which is downtown banners. So this ultimately, you know, was something that had been identified last winter when the proposal came to the council for holiday decorations, which we do have, and they will be debuting in winter 2020. But going into summer and kind of in keeping with the focus on what can we be doing to help businesses, this proposal would be to do a comprehensive reorder of some downtown banners. I'm sure you all noticed we have banners downtown, but it's not consistent that they're on every light pole once you hit Main Street and actually go through our core. And the idea here would be that we would start implementing seasonal banners. So we'd have some that actually go up in the spring and stay through the fall and are thematic and kind of welcoming people into our downtown core. And then in the winter time or late fall through early spring, we would switch over to a winter aesthetic. So I don't know if it made it out to you as an adjustment, but the update here on the memo that you received, which had just a holding line for the amount that we wanted the council to consider, that amount would be not to exceed $1,500. And that's basically an estimate that's still a little bit with some cushion, but accounting for the ordering of 10 new banners to go downtown on the light poles and hardware, because we have some missing hardware on light poles. So I think once we move forward with the order, similar to the parklets order, this is a not to exceed request. And ultimately, once we figure out how many pieces of hardware we actually do have, the estimate of 10 new hardware kits will probably get reduced. So I would expect that not to exceed won't be exceeded or even reached if we order all 10. But we wanted to bring it forward now so that we could, if we wanted to do this and get some installed, they would be going up about the time that we're actually entering into a more active phase and these restaurants are reopening and the parklets are there, and just thinking it could help enhance the overall aesthetic and vibe downtown.
And so according to the agenda memo, we currently have $12,000 budgeted in quote unquote community development. It was kind of a holding line item, looking at, you know, possibly doing some movies in the park, pool passes over at the Hood River Pool this summer. And so, you know, $1,500 of that $12,000 is a minor amount. But, you know, because the council had originally identified that money for, you know, some specific things, we won't have to amend the budget, but we just felt that we wanted you to authorize using that portion of that money for this purchase.
Any discussion or questions before we have a motion? Oh, Ashley, I think you're on mute.
I said, I think it's a good idea. Could any of the community development money go towards repainting crosswalks? Or would that be a totally different fund?
That's in the street budget.
Okay.
Yeah, and that is getting planned. The what has been an annual repainting.
Wonderful.
That has been mentioned and will be happening.
Awesome.
Cool. I'll make a motion to authorize expenditure of community development funds that were originally identified to be used for such things as movies in the park, pool passes, etc., to purchase new banners for the downtown light poles in an amount to exceed $1,500. To come out of the community development budget in the current expense fund.
Is there a second?
Second.
Jason Hartman made the motion. Joe Turkowitz seconded. Any more discussion?
Just the question.
Yeah.
So, Marla, are you looking at and jam banners to go across Jewett Boulevard from the light pole to the new flagpole?
No, this is just...
Well, yeah, this is not part of that. Now, I'll let's mention that. But now that we have a light pole outside of the police station, there is the opportunity to string things across Jewett. We did that primarily for our holiday decorations, which this winter will have a season's greeting sign. This proposal is not factoring that in. I just didn't feel confident that we had enough of a plan of what our message would be to have a cost assigned to it. But that is an option. So if a counselor has an idea, or, you know, it becomes clear that maybe that is a good way to further some other messaging that's either COVID appropriate or just seasonal for summer, that could be considered.
And that cost will be a little bit more because it'll have to be constructed in a specific way to handle the wind load. I.e., it'll have to have holes in it. Or it will be flying down the road.
probably fly down the road one way or the other.
I hope not. But if you put holes in it, if it has strategically placed cutouts, then it helps reduce that wind pressure on them.
Any other questions or thoughts? Okay, Jan, would you like to do a roll call vote?
Jason Harmon?
Aye.
David Lindley?
Aye.
Ashley Post?
Aye.
Joe Turkowitz? Joe?
Aye.
Okay, thank you. Motion carries.
Okay, now moving to our added agenda item, the ice leakage request.
So,
Jan, would you like to give the overview?
Yeah, I emailed you the documents related to this, including the ordinance that pertains to this. And so, just to summarize, ICE had a substantial leakage at their property. 880,000 gallons of water compared to the usage of last year, which was 72,000 gallons of water. And so there's a process that we calculate. They found the leak. They found a wet area in their grass. I don't know that they've been operating 24/7 there. And then they hired Camps Plumbing LLC to make the repairs. The copy of the invoice is there. There's some other documentation. So the code has a formula for how we calculate the adjustment. They don't get a full adjustment. And so the adjustment that I'm asking for totals $2,901.36, of which $1,551.36 is an adjustment towards water usage billing, and $1,350 is an adjustment towards a sewer overage. So typically we don't see these very often for businesses. We typically see them for residential leakage. And so for residential leakage, there's never, they're not billed for sewer overage. They're just billed for a base fee. And so you never see an adjustment to the sewer overage charges for residential. This is exceeds $500. So I am required to request your authorization to make this adjustment to Innovative Composites Engineering.
Does Bingen have to waive the sewer overage as well?
No. So what we do is we pay based on the amounts that are billed. So
I see. That, based on water usage?
Right.
Okay.
So there's nothing required of Bingen.
Got it. I'll make the motion to authorize Clerk Treasurer to make an adjustment to Innovative Composites Engineering's utility account in the amount of $2,901.36.
I'll second that.
Okay, Jason made the motion, Ashley seconded. Any more discussion?
I'm just trying to remember. So with this policy, is it a one-time only?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Is there any difference in the policy between residents and businesses?
No.
Okay.
Okay. Jan, can you take a roll call vote?
Jason Hartman.
Aye.
David Lindley.
Aye.
Ashley Post.
Aye.
Joe Turkowitz.
Aye.
Motion carries.
So does that motion, just by what you explained as the binging relationship, does that motion then naturally include the $1,900 charge for sewer?
Yes, the total amount includes the $1,350 for sewer. So the
$2,900 and something includes the sewer, is that right?
Yes, it does.
Okay, thank you.
Well, if it's leaking, it's not really going in the sewer.
That's correct.
Good point.
Yeah.
Touché.
Age-old argument.
What if it didn't
work? So I think we are next moving into an.
Okay, Marla, we've lost your voice.
Oh.
Okay.
Sorry, guys. Do you hear me now? Okay.
Yes.
I think now on our agenda, we're actually moving into our first virtual executive session. Jan, I know you sent out separate dial-in information.
Yes.
Does everyone have that?
I will start that meeting on my cell phone. We will pause the recording of this meeting. We do need to announce that we're meeting an executive session to discuss potential litigation pursuant to RCW 42.30.1101i, and you'll need to identify for how long the executive session will take place.
And so also one question I have, are we asking that counselors and staff attending use the web link so that we're looking at each other, or are we just using the
phone
numbers for an executive phone call?
You can use the web link, but there won't be any video.
Is this in the
great.
Is this the Google meeting link?
It's not a Google meeting,
yeah.
It's a Zoom.
Okay.
Zoom. It's at the bottom of that count. If you scroll through, it'll be at the bottom.
Yeah, the invite, Google invites now have default Google Hangout options, so you just have to be careful. The first.
So is it from Jan or from Marla? Because I'm looking at two.
It's
here.
From me. So look at my
yeah,
email that I sent this morning.
If you have Jan's email, it's the same thing I sent in a calendar. Sometimes if you have a lot in your inbox, it's easier to just go to the calendar and look at the info. But in either place, it's the same information from Jan.
Okay, I'm gonna log out of this one and then log back in because I don't have any cell service in my house. So
yeah, and that'll work. I'm just gonna. Okay. We do need to announce how long, because I do believe we have. Well, I think we may not have anyone attending. So there's no one else currently online except for council and staff, and so you'll also need to indicate which staff will participate. And that would probably be myself and Pat.
And Ken.
And Ken.
You can't do a little eye without me.
Sorry, Ken. Can't have an executive session on potential litigation without an attorney.
That's right.
So does it sound reasonable, Pat and Ken, a time frame of 10 minutes for this executive session? Or do you think we need 15?
It'll probably take me 10 minutes to figure this out. Yeah.
Okay, we will factor in some
tech support.
So we'll say 15 minutes.
So we come out of this Zoom meeting and go into the other Zoom meeting.
Yes, and then come back to this one.
So let's say resume at 7:45.
Resume at 7:45. Okay, I'm going to now pause this meeting, recording of it, and then I will start the other meeting.